Welcome to the Geneva Graduate Institute In Conversation With podcast series. I'm Lena Menge, Manager of Strategic Partnerships and Public Relations. This episode features a conversation between Barry Aiken-Green, the George and Ellen Pardee Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and Rhys Estevez, Professor of International History and Politics at the Geneva Graduate Institute. The dramatic economic and financial measures taken by the United States and its allies in response to Russia's attack on Ukraine point up the potency but also the limits of economic power. The International Monetary Fund forecasts that Russia will cause the country's economy to contract by 9% in 2022. Yet, there are no visible signs of this intervention inducing the Kremlin to halt its war on Ukraine or even to modify its prosecution of the war. Have Western sanctions failed? More globally, what is the future of international liberalism and economic integration given the current geopolitical context?
Welcome, Barry. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this. And today we want to have a short discussion with you on some of your most recent topics of research. So in particular, in some of your more recent papers, you've been looking at the projection of economic power, either between nations vying for leadership, think of the China versus US scrambles, or as a means to achieve some political aims, like stopping the war in Ukraine, or at least punishing Russia for it. Now, an ongoing source of puzzlement has been the apparent lack of bite of Western sanctions against Russia. In your opinion, are economic sanctions useless in this case, or we just need to expect longer to see those results?
I think we need to wait longer. One thing we do know is that sanctions are least effective when they're imposed on autocrats, on autocratic governments. Sanctions hit not only the oligarchs who may be targeted and government leaders, but they often cause some hardship for the population. That's unavoidable. And in some sense, it's one of the channels through which sanctions work. And autocrats like Mr. Putin, who control the military, the secret police, so forth, don't have to be as responsive to their public as democratically elected leaders. I think sanctions still can work if they are comprehensive, if they are coordinated internationally, and if the sanctioning powers stay the course. And there's a lot of worry and talk at the moment about whether the Western alliance, especially European countries, will be prepared to stay the course through a cold winter.
That's interesting. So because that raises an immediate question, right? So again, is economic power harder to project, not only because in this particular case it's being applied against autocrats, but also because it necessarily relies on the compliance of the private sector? So you mentioned that there's doubts whether a group of nations in the European Union will stay the course, but how about its own private sector, the companies through which inevitably these economic sanctions have to be applied?
Well, I that's right, that economic power requires the cooperation of the private sector. The private sector has to be enlisted, whether it's U.S. banks or Dutch producers of semiconductor machinery. But military power, conventional military power, is hard to project in the 21st century. So we have seen the Russian army get bogged down in Ukraine. And I am hopeful that one of the silver linings of this terrible war in Ukraine will be that President Xi and others contemplating what to do about Taiwan will be deterred from launching a land war by television pictures of how that is playing out in Russia. So both economic power and military power require the compliance, as you put it, of the private sector. The private sector has to produce the weaponry, and when the cupboard is bare, it has to produce more. The story of World War II in the United States was the story of private companies, from Ford producing tanks to Henry Kaiser on the West Coast producing the Pacific Fleet. So it applies in both cases.
Indeed, right. You can also project power positively, not only negatively. So a related puzzlement. So in general, people look at the exchange rate as a summary measure of how well a country is doing. And so the initial dive of the ruble was interpreted by everyone as a measure of how effective these sanctions might apply in the future, as an anticipation of the economic cost. But of course, we know that the ruble since has recovered and is actually higher than the pre-invasion level, actually higher than the last 5 years. So how do you explain this? How is it possible that the ruble recovered despite the weight of growing sanctions and pressure? And in particular, is this just due to the gimmick that Mr. Putin forcing unfriendly nations to pay for their energy imports from Russian rubles?
Well, a lot of people point to the recovery, to the strength of the ruble, and say Western sanctions have failed. I think that's incorrect. And I have some research that documents that fact. So my paper on this topic is joint with some researchers at the Bank of France and the European Central Bank. So you will not have seen it yet. It has to go through the clearance process at these institutions before it's ready for release. But what it basically does is distinguishes sanctions that prevent a country from exporting, in Russia's case, oil, gas, and so forth, versus sanctions that prevent it from importing spare parts for aircraft, for the military, and so forth. Sanctions on that prevent a country from importing strengthen its exchange rate because it's going to be accumulating foreign exchange dollars and other revenues through whatever exports it's continuing to be able to supply. So what we're really seeing is that the sanctions on Russia's ability to import stuff are really biting, and that's showing up in the strength of the ruble. So I take that as evidence that what has been done is working to an extent.
That's very interesting. So essentially you're saying that the strength of the ruble is a measure of successful import restrictions, or the success of the sanctions on the ability of the Russian economy to continue to import.
Right, because initially we thought that the ruble would move in response to financial flows, mm-hmm. that there might be large-scale capital flight from Russia, and the ruble would crash as a result. Russia's financial markets have been shut down, or at least cross-border financial transactions have been shut down. So what moves the ruble is the trade account, or the current account. And that's why it has moved in the other direction than many of us initially thought.
Very clear. Thank you. But there's a bigger picture in all of this, right? And there's been for a while, which is the return of barefaced political rivalry at a geopolitical level. And many commentators and researchers have been asking themselves whether this is just not the beginning of the end of globalization. Do you agree with this scenario? Or how would you see it played off?
I think the future of globalization hinges on U.S.-Chinese relations much more than on what a Russia that accounts for barely 3% of global GDP does or does not do. Given the already frayed state of U.S.-Chinese relations, we're seeing diversification of trade. So Apple is moving iPhone production from China to Vietnam, from China to India. Globalization continues and survives in a somewhat different form. Maybe there are some mild inefficiencies in having to produce in the second or third best place, given labor costs and efficiency and so forth, as opposed to the first best place. But the advantages of globalization remain. I guess my view is that if globalization could survive Donald Trump, it can survive anything except an outright shooting war between the U.S. and China over Taiwan or something like that. And given that what we thought the rules of the geopolitical game in the 21st century were, they're no longer the rules, apparently. It's the unfortunate fact that we can't rule anything out. But I think we have to hope that the other lesson the Chinese have drawn from Russia's war on Ukraine is that that kind of action is very disruptive economically. China values economic growth. I think the implicit promise of the regime to deliver growth and higher living standards is the crux of Chinese political economy. Not so much in Russia. I'm not sure what Mr. Putin's bargain with his population is, make Russia an empire again or something. But I think, again, President Xi and the Politburo will understand that getting into a hot war with the United States over Taiwan would be fatal for globalization, but it would be brutal for the Chinese economy as well.
I agree, but that's only an extreme scenario of the unraveling of the international liberal order. An alternative one would be a return to regionalization, a creation of trade and monetary and financial blocks that would be less integrated than they are today. And you know, we know that the Chinese government seems to have been thinking about those lines by, you know, funding international economies, by creating the Belt and Road Initiative, by trying to create an alternative to the dominance of the dollar, right? So that's a conceivable alternative scenario, right? Is that more likely in your view, or still not in the Chinese?
So I think the only place where it's likely is where it exists, namely in Europe. And I also think that Europe is sui generis because of its history. I don't see serious progress in the direction of regionalism in Latin America or Africa or South Asia. Mm-hmm. It's only in East Asia where you can imagine echoes of what has been done in Western Europe. Moreover, if you look at China's Belt and Road investments, they're not only in Asia, they're all over the world. So it views this as building a global trading network where it has refueling stations and military bases on every continent. So I don't see the global economy breaking into a series of well-defined blocks, maybe a set of somewhat overlapping networks instead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you're also a very well-known authority on reserve currencies and the dominance of the dollar, and you've been on record for more than 10 years as predicting a steady erosion of the dominance of the U.S. dollar in the international monetary arena. And again, spurted by the current Ukrainian crisis, some people say that the crisis may accelerate this, as Russia and the countries that refuse to play ball with the Western sanctions try to find a way of continuing to trade amongst themselves and exchange their currencies away from the Western or the U.S.-dominated systems. Now, so again, I return to my rise of regionalism question, but from the monetary angle. So do you agree, one, that this steady erosion of the U.S. dollar just accelerated because of these endogenous reactions? And where do you see the world going in these terms?
I can imagine the movement away from the dollar, which has been proceeding, to give you one statistic, the dollar's share of global foreign exchange reserves held by central banks and governments has been declining by 0.5%, 0.5 percentage point per year for the last couple of decades. Between 2002 and 2022, it fell from 70% of the world total to 60% of the world total. And normally I would expect that to continue as emerging markets continue to emerge and the U.S. grows slowly, slowly less dominant as an economic and financial power. Will that trend now accelerate? I think the answer is unclear, because it was not only the dollar that was weaponized, but these financial sanctions were imposed by a coalition of Western countries, by the G7, together with South Korea and a number of others. So where exactly could a country imagining that it will be on the outs with the United States and the Western coalition go? There's one obvious answer, China, which when you think about it is not all that obvious. Given Putin's demonstration of how unpredictable and autocrat, not subject to political checks and balances, can be. Would you really want to park your reserves in Shanghai where Mr. Xi and the Politburo can change the rules of the game? So I'm not sure that recent events enhance the attractions of the renminbi as an international and reserve currency. So the research that I've done suggests that most of the movement away from the dollar has been movement in the direction of non-traditional subsidiary reserve currencies, the currencies of smaller countries like Singapore, Norway, Canada, Australia, South Korea. New trading technologies and the like make it easier to get in and out of those currencies. And I think we will continue to see movement in that direction. So, Rui, in your question, you said I've been predicting this for 10 years. Two answers to that will be one, I'll continue predicting it until I'm right. The other one is that I made two predictions in that book, Exorbitant Privilege. One was there would be gradual erosion of the dominance of the dollar, and that was correct. And the other prediction was that movement would be toward the currencies of the two other big economies, the euro area and China. And that prediction turned out to be wrong. It's the subsidiary reserve currencies that have been gaining.
But that's interesting, right? Because what I've learned of the economics of reserve currencies would lead me to expect that that wouldn't be a stable equilibrium, right? I can imagine a multipolar equilibrium with three large currencies, right? And they're large and hence liquid, and that generates all manner of network externalities that make them a stable equilibrium. But what you're describing instead seems to be a situation where you have one leading currency and then a fringe of small alternative assets. Am I right, or have I lost track with the literature?
No, that's what I'm envisaging, and I think we need to dig up our old industrial organization models of a dominant firm with a competitive fringe and see how they work.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, since we are in 2022, of course, I have to ask you a question about cryptocurrencies, right? Both the privately created and the central bank alternatives. So essentially, the question is, do you see them as an alternative or as a useful new class of assets in this multipolar world of international currencies? Do they provide an alternative, perhaps? You know, you can think of them as a way of creating maybe international currencies that are less dependent on the political and the policy priorities of the nations that currently issue them.
When I think about this, I distinguish three kinds of crypto: plain vanilla cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, which are volatile, which are not good portfolio diversifiers. When the stock and bond markets went down, crypto, Bitcoin went down, etc. They depend on liquidity in the same way these other markets do. And transactions on the blockchain can be traced by the authorities, so they can't be used to evade sanctions, even if you wanted to. Stablecoins lack the volatility drawback. They have not proven either to be stable or to be scalable. So to be stable, you've got to fully collateralize them or over-collateralize them. So I have to give you more than one U.S. dollar in order to get $1 worth of Tether, a stablecoin, back from you. And that doesn't strike me as a good bargain under most cases. The variant that has legs, if you will, is central bank digital currency. And I think those are coming at different rates in different countries. China is moving fast. The U.S. is moving slow. The ECB is moving slow. I'm not sure that the benefits outweigh the risks, but there is momentum behind that process. The last stage of the game will be if and when they are finally used for cross-border transactions. China's ECNY can only be used in China. And how it could be used in cross-border transactions without undermining China's capital controls is not clear. I can imagine 120 central bank digital currencies of 120 countries running on a single blockchain. Technically, we know how to do that. But politically, do we know how to govern, regulate the operation of that single blockchain? This is like disagreements about how to run the World Trade Organization squared.
Indeed. But effectively, we live in a world where there is such an international system, not connecting central bank-issued currency, but commercial banks-issued currency. It's called SWIFT, right? And we sort of delegated the governance of that to the private sector under the dominance of a particular reserve currency. If I may push you a little bit more, right? So you just described a technically feasible world where we would have 120 CBDCs working on the same platform. If that's technically feasible, why can't we find a governance solution that works, since SWIFT has been working until recently?
So maybe someday we will. SWIFT, however, I remind you, doesn't do any payments. They don't actually move any money. We use it to send financial messages that instruct banks to take money from one counterparty's account and place it in a second counterparty's account. So I think it is easier to figure out how to run a messaging system that was built to send telegrams and now works electronically than it would be to govern the operation of a blockchain with scores of currencies running on it.
Okay. So you would replace a messaging system between private ledgers with a fully integrated system of one public ledger between different currencies. So perhaps related, we all know that China is trying to internationalize the renminbi at the same time that, in a way that does not harm its capital controls, and in particular has been trying to push this cross-border interbank payment system. Again, would you see that as the basis for a regional monetary hegemony of the renminbi in a way that wouldn't necessarily go after the dominance of the dollar, but would so do regionally or something more?
So I've been trying to put together some information on China's clearinghouse, this cross-border interbank payments system. And it's very hard to build a list of which banks actually participate in it, have accounts directly with it because they have branches in China, or that participate indirectly by doing business through one of those direct participants. But you can verify that there are a bunch of Western banks that participate in it in the same way that there are a bunch of Chinese banks that participate in CHIPS, the New York clearinghouse. So again, to circle back to more or less where we began, I don't see China building its own interbank payment system as building a regional system necessarily, but rather as building a renminbi-based payments system that can be used to undertake transactions with banks in every part of the world.
Very well. So we'll have a world of overlapping geographies. Well, thank you very much, Barry. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you come back soon.
Thank you.
That was Barry Aiken-Green and Ria Stevis discussing the effectiveness of sanctions in the context of the war in Ukraine and the US dollar's future as a reserve currency. For more information about the Institute, please visit graduateinstitute.ch. I'm Lena Menge. Thanks for listening.